Manasseh is the one who has been chosen to deliver the goods here. So he's by training a sociologist and interested in statistics. And of course, we're all interested in statistics too, and there'll be a lot of discussion about numbers here today. So, Professor Massey.
Thank you very much, Joe, and thank you very much to all of the participants, and good afternoon on behalf of McGill University. I am the provost, and for some people that's a title that doesn't mean much, but as the provost, I'm the chief academic officer of the university, so that means all of the deans have report to me, and I'm also the chief budget officer, which means all of the deans have to be nice to me. So I get the combination of those two things is what my job is. But it is a real pleasure to have you here for this roundtable discussion, which forms part of the Trottier Symposia that we have now been fortunate enough to have for 9 years, I think, going into this. And during the course of the academic year, I have lots of occasions to welcome people to the campus and to speak with them about the things that they're interested in and to hear a lot of interesting interventions. But these annual Trottier Symposia have become what we look forward to every fall at the university, because they mark a really important part of our outreach to the community about what science really means. And that's really what these symposia are about. They're about real science. And they have posed interesting and important questions during the entire 9 years that they have been part of the landscape of McGill University's intellectual community. And they represent outreach. And the two symposia this evening and tomorrow evening will actually have much larger audiences and will involve interaction with the public. These symposia have, as I said, taken on a life at McGill that is due in exclusively, really, to the hard work of a group of scientists in the Office for Science and Society, the Department of Chemistry at McGill, but they're sponsored by Dr. Lorne Trottier and the Trottier Family Foundation. And these are things we, as a publicly funded institution, would probably not be able to do were it not for the generosity of donors like Lorne and his family. And the foundation really matters to the way in which this university functions. In fact, the entire Office of Science and Office for Science and Society now bears the name Trottier. These events, by inviting distinguished lecturers from around the world to come to the university over the years, the series has provided McGill and the Montreal communities with far-reaching opportunities to discuss critical thinking, complex scientific issues ranging from things like the spark of life to climate change to alternative medicine. But this afternoon, and in fact the symposium's entire topic is that fact, is really at the heart of what it means to generate scientific information. As Joe said, I'm by training a sociologist demographer. I'm a quantitative sociologist, and that has meant I spent a large part of my life looking at labor force data and information about industrial sectors across several continents. I have always, as a quantitative sociologist, taught my students that a fact must be based on empirical evidence. That's easier said than it is to actually realize. But empirical evidence should be objective. An observation that is objective, and the observation should be verifiable. So the process of establishing facts is tightly bound to what I define for my own students as the scientific method. Nonetheless, as a social scientist, I'm also well aware that we have sometimes have a difficulty in separating what an established fact is from the frame of reference that we use to look at it theoretically. So the facts are often influenced by the method of observation itself or by the frames of reference we hold in terms of interpreting what we see. In other words, factual conclusions may be socially constructed rather than just based on method, and that should be part of what forms is that a fact. Findings, of course, accumulate in science and they become anomalous with regard to the truths that have emerged, so we often have to engage in changing the way in which we think about science. These are the paradigm shifts that Thomas Kuhn talked about in his book on scientific revolutions. I teach my students to understand facts in the following way. Is what you are being told a simple assertion without evidence? If it is, you should discard it. The second thing I say is, if evidence is offered only in the form of an appeal to authority, you have to question whether or not that individual is truly an authority. and what sources they use for accumulating their evidence. Is the observation based, is the fact based on an observation, and is that observation simply one-off or ad hoc, or has it been gathered in some systematic way that can be replicated? I also tell them that in order for us to build our enterprise about knowledge and facts, we have to make sure that whatever it is we're trying to study, the phenomena has a good description, that description can then be tied to a coherent explanation, that the explanation can help us to provide predictions, and that if those predictions come true, in some cases we might actually be able to control the events that we're studying. So again, as I said, it is important as an academic for me that facts get established in a certain way. But I'm also the provost of the university, and as an administrator, I've come to learn another thing. That is, if people think things are real, then they have real consequences. And that social psychological insight, dating back over 125 years from W.I. Thomas, is really an important part of what our world is like today. People think things are real, and then they, in effect, have real consequences. This roundtable will start a discussion of many of the questions that Joe Schwartz has circulated for us to consider in this conversation, but I really want to just stop there by thanking all of you for taking part in this conversation. It's a very important one, and the symposia this evening will and tomorrow evening will also be important parts of what Trottier and the Trottier Family Foundation have done for McGill, so I want to thank Lauren personally, and I will stay for as long as I can, but I do have other obligations in terms of the university, but I'm going to stay and listen to this conversation for as long as I can. So thank you very much.
Thank you. Well, to start off, we'll just go around the table, and I will do a quick introduction so everyone knows who everyone else is. I won't do very elaborate ones because, after all, we want to talk about more important issues. Lauren Trottier, of course, is the benefactor who makes all of this possible, and you've already heard about Lauren's efforts. Bill Brownstein is a columnist with the Montreal Gazette, who knows one or two things about facts and checking them. David Tarp is going to join us a little bit later. He's a professor of chemistry, but he's at an important academic meeting, so he'll come to us. Kirsten Thistle comes to us from Washington, and she flew up just for this event today. She's in a public relations company called APCO Worldwide, and they deal with a lot of scientific issues, such as concerns about bisphenol A and phthalates, etc., and try to separate fact from fiction. André Picard is the science columnist for the Globe and Mail, which is sort of Canada's national newspaper. Ariel Fenster is my colleague in the Office for Science and Society. Dr. Christopher Pack is in the Department of Neurology. And we share a passion, again, for separating sense from nonsense. Tommy Schnurmacher is a radio host here in Montreal, sort of a Montreal institution, has been on CJD for, 17 years?
Yes.
17 years. He has a daily show, and we've often collaborated and had fun poking various kind of fun at the homeopaths. Dr. Ari Benchetrit is a plastic surgeon in Montreal. He works at the Lakeshore Hospital and also shares the common interest that we have here of making sure that science is sound. Julie Payette is the chief operating officer of the Montreal Science Center now, but in former life she was an astronaut and she knows something about facts too. I think she's the only one at this table who can verify that the Earth is round. Is that correct?
Spherical, empirical.
Empirical, yeah.
Spherical.
Spherical.
You know it was round. Well, this is going to be interesting.
Can you actually see that it's round?
That is spherical?
Yeah.
That's the third dimension.
Timothy Caulfield is a lawyer from Alberta, but that's not really his claim to fame. He is also very interested in science, and he has written a wonderful book that tells us how we can cure every disease known to mankind. So we are thankful for that. Dr. Johnny Anidis comes to us from California, from Stanford University, and he has written a number of fascinating articles. And the one that really caught the public and the scientific world's attention was a paper published in 2005 in which he contends that a vast number of scientific papers that are published are actually deeply flawed. Dr. Eugenie Scott also comes from California, although from the northern part, and she is the chief executive officer of the National Science Education. National Center for Science Education,
which
is I should stick to the initials, which is devoted to spreading good science and also to make sure that kids are properly educated about evolution. And as you can imagine, in the U.S., that is quite a challenge. Michael Spector is a staff writer with The New Yorker, which of course has a huge circulation, and his articles are extensive, in-depth discussions of numerous issues, including examinations of some very well-known personae. Lance Armstrong and Dr. Oz come to mind. And of course he has a huge audience, because anything that gets written in The New Yorker gets a huge audience. Not as much as Bill's articles in The Gazette. So that's the group that we have here. And I proposed some questions that I think are interesting in terms of discussion. And so let's see what we can do with these. And they're sort of topics that everyone here somehow can relate to. And the first one, I think, is one that all of us contend with some fashion in our lives, and that is, who do we trust? How do we know what's true? I mean, some of the quacks and the charlatans out there sound very good. Tommy was just telling me earlier, he had a guest on who was a naturopath on the show, and sounded very believable, right? So maybe, Tommy, you can get this one going.
Yes, well, the naturopath sounded very reasonable. She didn't claim that any single supplement would cure absolutely everything. And when an anonymous person, whose name I won't mention right now, Dr. Joe called my producer to ask her about vaccines, what is your take on vaccines? So she pauses for a second and says, that's a very controversial issue. And then she says something about at a young age, you have to be careful and consider and ask some questions. And then she leaves it up to people how they feel about it. And so I said, so you're not against, I wanted to see if I could catch her directly, so you're not against vaccines? No, I'm not, was her answer. But she was one of the smartest ones. I've had guests in, and Lauren will be upset at me for this, who have said that oil of oregano really means you don't need any doctors anymore at all, because it can cure absolutely everything.
Although I remember with the vaccine thing, though, she did say that there are alternate vaccine schemes
yes,
that she recommends.
She did mention that. But what's really terrifying about all of it, I mean, my show's done for education and for entertainment purposes as well. What's terrifying is you can spend half an hour explaining how bad something is, it's nonsense, no one in their right mind would use this or thinks that oil of oregano can do anything, then I'll get emails, what's the name of that product and where can I go buy it? This is after half an hour of debunking with all the facts and figures presented, they're still ready to buy.
So anyone else who is...
Which brings up the question of, why do you trust person A versus person B?
Well, it's so funny. CJD, the criteria is whenever we get anything, like I get across the transom all kinds of people who have all kinds of suggestions for interviews and cures for this and magic potions and diets and everything else. And I said, well, I tell my producer, first call Dr. Joe. Ask Dr. Joe, see what does he say? And then we proceed from there in terms of how seriously we are. So the question for me, who do you trust? Very simple. I trust Dr. Joe. I run it by him. Whatever it is, I run it by him. I run it by him first.
Okay,
this doesn't mean I won't do it if he says no.
But let's go up 10,000 feet. Why do you trust Dr. Joe? I mean, I think a very basic principle out here, and those of you who are psychologists would know more than I would, that you trust people who are like you in some way.
Yes.
There has to be that personal connection. Someone who is like you is more likely to be trusted than somebody who is very, very much unlike you. And someone who treats you well, as opposed to someone who insults you, someone who denigrates you, is more likely to be trusted than somebody who doesn't treat you well. Those seem to me to be the most important features, more so than authority, because we'll set aside authority if the authority, if the point of view that's being expressed is not something that sits well with us. So I think it's a very complicated question you're asking.
Well, I think you pegged it. We're about the same age. We're both Hungarian. You're right.
Could be something. Who wouldn't?
But that's a very good point, and that goes back to the Google versus Facebook argument. There were some interesting articles written about how Facebook will eventually overtake Google as the major search engine, because Google basically uses an algorithm when you're doing a search, and generally the more read or better articles will come up first. Whereas Facebook, the searches are based on likes and what your friends mm-hmm. like. And many people think that people will more naturally venture towards what their friends have recommended versus what the science has recommended. And it's a little bit of a scary thought where people are now going to come in and say, well, I researched this on Facebook and it's based on
it's
the fact
that... It's a scary thought that people say, well, I've researched this on Google or on Wikipedia. Though Google is... their algorithm is basically a sophisticated popularity contest.
Right.
And if you don't believe that, go search for how many home runs Mickey Mantle hit in 1958. Because it'll come up with an answer. And unless things have changed very recently, it will be wrong. Because it will be referring to fantasy baseball. And fantasy baseball is more linked to than Yankee statistics. So it pops up sooner and seems like the truth. So the truth to a lot of people is the thing that's most popular. And that is something that's really scary. And I'm a huge Google fan. I'm not saying this in a negative way. It's just that none of these sources of information by themselves can ever be satisfactory by themselves.
Well, I don't think it's more than that. I mean, I think that you say that, and the question is the onslaught of information is contradictory. It's also fragmented, right? So people can use popularity, but they can also use their own biases to find information that confirms whatever they say. So someone can go online and they can find authority that will support anything an astronaut says, right? And unless you have some kind of filter or knowledge, you can do that for any topic. And this fragmentation of the media, I think, is a real challenge, I think, for science education.
Well, Ari, how long have you been practicing?
22 years.
So how would you compare patients coming in now to ones that came in then, when I'm sure you were the ultimate authority, and now I bet that they come in with reams of printouts from, right?
Well, yeah, at a panel we had a couple of years ago, if you remember, I said that the three words that I hated the most in my practice were, I heard that. You know, patients would come in and say, I heard that, and then they'd go on, and of course, who did you hear it from? Well, my sister, my neighbor, my cousin. Now it's, I read that. It's been replaced by, I read that, because they've gone to Wikipedia or Google or Facebook, and now they've got a higher authority, or so they think, without actually discerning where that opinion came from. So they do come in with rings of information. Some of it not bad. Some of my patients actually take the time to look at the source of that information, but most don't. They just go to whatever's highest on the...
On balance, is it better now that they have access to more information?
Yes and no. It's demystified what I do, and for that I'm grateful, because patients are naturally very nervous about surgery or other medical procedures. Many of them have already seen their surgery on YouTube before they've even come to see me, which is quite interesting. And many of them tell me, do you use so-and-so's technique, which is even putting even more pressure on me. So, but of course, a lot of them gather the wrong information, or they've gone to the wrong site, or they form their opinion based on misinformation.
Source. Two people said it. Source. Mm-hmm. It's a big differentiator. And the redundancy of it. I have a 10-year-old at home who's very, very much into electronics, so he's starting Googling and using the computer to find information. And so I teach him very basic fact that if you are looking for something about offspring, you go to a site that at least is serious. He can't judge that at 10 years old, but as an adult, we're supposed to be able to at least differentiate that Or maybe if you are reading a Scientology website versus, say, the Globe and Mail or the New Yorker, well, about evolution, then maybe you will get a different type of seriousness in the answer. But it's the rule of three, I say. If you can get three sources that you judge seriously saying the same thing, then you're a lot closer to a fact than you were before. Because that will corroborate that this is the base knowledge that is out there. You can find that on Wikipedia. There's good things on Wikipedia. You need to corroborate. Be skeptical that one source is not sufficient, and one source that you can't tag as serious is definitely not sufficient.
But on vaccines, I was like, we've been working on the vaccine issue since the Wakefield study came out in 98. And you know, I think what we have found, just doing extensive research about opinions and behavior and what parents will do, you know, we can take Paul Offit from Children's Hospital of Philadelphia, and he can give a great presentation and talk about the science, and people are wowed by it. But ultimately, what's moving the needle on getting people immunized is what their friends are saying, or what their school nurse says, or what the PTA president says to them.
And
it's somebody they trust. And unfortunately, in certain areas of the country, there are many more people who don't trust vaccines in places like, you know, Seattle and Ashland, Oregon, and parts of New York. But you know, I think that with this sort of great leveler of the internet, there's a much tougher battle, I think, to trickle down good science and to connect that with the social norming exercise that gets patients and consumers and parents to make the right decisions about many of these issues that they don't really understand because they don't understand the science.
So you're thinking about good science. There's also a lot of bad science, and there's a lot of poor quality studies and reviews that come out that confuse the issue, and activists like the anti-vaccine activists, they like to harp on that. I know that John Leonidas, what's your name there, has written a whole bunch of stuff there about how much research is wrong, and that further confuses the picture. So how do we communicate that?
It's important for the wider public to understand what are the issues where there's no evidence or no data or preliminary data or questionable data or debated information versus areas where there's non-scientific approaches. So I think some basic distinction of whether the source of information is scientific versus non-scientific is like the first thing that we should try to educate the public, and this is something that should happen very early. I mean, it's a very different thing if people are debating about a scientific theory or interpreting the results of a study or whether it's replicated or not, or how strong the effects are, whether they're weaker than we thought originally, versus something that is completely off, and you know, is some theory that based on dogma, religion, political affiliation, or whatever non-scientific background. And this is not very easy to differentiate, because most people, when they see an information source, obviously there's no tag. This is scientific, or this is philosophical, or extra scientific, and. Probably, if we try to educate the wider public about asking for the documentation behind the statements. Is that based on studies? What kind of studies? Are they big studies, well-controlled, experimental, or is it more hearsay, it's more belief, it's more my opinion? Then we may be asking for a step in terms of education, but it's a crucial step, because otherwise, I can say for many fields that I'm not familiar with, if I hit the internet, it's very difficult for me to understand what's going on here.
I think that points to a real role for scientific societies, like the National Academies or the Society for Neuroscience, because they sort of do what you were saying you want your son to do. They aggregate the opinions of a lot of people and sort of put them together into a document that's easily accessible, almost always online, and very, very unlikely to be totally wrong or misguided.
But the problem with that is that people need to know that that particular society is trustworthy. For instance, I teach a class on the future of food, how we're going to feed the world in 50 years, and I asked the kids to give me a rough draft of their projects last week with sources. Some of the sources were delightful, and a lot of them were the Huffington Post, which is, as far as I'm concerned, is the astrology pages. And these are smart kids, but I don't think they've ever been told, this is a source you should trust. These are, and we need to do that. And the other thing is,
I think authority is a bad name. I mean,
It does.
You have to look at it as at least as kind of a necessary criteria for being able to pass judgment on something that's a complex scientific topic. But if you're sufficient for being right, you could certainly be an authority and be wrong, but it ought to be viewed as at least necessary.
But I think what Dr. Ioannidis, I'm sorry if I'm mispronouncing it, says is really true. A lot of people say, gee, how can, science is so complicated, how can we know? And sometimes that's a difficult question to answer, but sometimes it's not. You know, is a study of 27 people at one place, or is it of 270,000 or 2 million over 20 years at 13 sites? You know, you can look at the studies, you can look at who did them, you can look at how many people, you can look and see whether it's the only study of its kind, and get at least a sense of whether something's ridiculous.
That's what you can. We don't use that.
But I mean, that's something people...
They can, but you know what I mean? The study that came out last week, the BPA study of 168 women who have fertility issues, and it showed that 60%, women were more likely, 60% chances of having a miscarriage if they had higher levels of bisphenol A. So here's a study, 160 people, women who have... It was all over the place. I mean, yeah. And we know these reporters who covered this. I mean, these are top science reporters who are writing stories in the New York Times and the Wall Street Journal. In fact, doctors we work with got calls from women they are treating for fertility issues saying, what do I do? I've got plastics in my house. Should I get rid of them? Should I get them all out? Should I not use the microwave? Like, should I move to another planet where there's no BPA?
Which planet would they go to?
Exactly. So one without polycarbonate, I guess. But, you know, I think the problem is that people, there's no... The average consumer doesn't make the distinction. They are trusting Lazebo or Laura Neergaard or somebody like that to filter all this information and these societies to aggregate and curate and sort of give them render some sort of solution or decision for them.
I agree. I'm just saying it shouldn't be that hard for educators, many of you people in this room, to sort of lay out criterion for evaluating people, and some people will take it and some won't. But I don't think it's laid out very much or very often.
Even if it is laid out, I mean, speaking on behalf of the public, they're extremely confused. They don't know themselves, so they're looking to various areas of expertise. And if they're reading the science reporter from the New York Times or the Wall Street Journal or the Globe and Mail, that's absolutely the gold standard as far as they're concerned. And then when it comes to something as simple as diets, one of the things that they don't want to hear is 95% of people who lose weight gave it back. That may be a fact, but nobody wants to hear that or look at that or examine that or hear studies about that or anything. But what they want to do is take one of two sides. Like in the States, it's Republican and Democrat. On diet, it's fat good or fat bad. That's the current battle, and each side has untold wealth of scientists on their side, from Dean Ornish on one side to Dr. Atkins, may he rest in peace, on the other. And they all have tons and tons of information, which is difficult for even experts to sort through. How on earth is the general public supposed to
through agencies, right? Like in Canada, we don't enjoy this kind of immense authority. But I don't know if you noticed, but last week for the opt-in time, the mass media, CNN, predicted that we had an asteroid come by the Earth in September. And remember, there was this whole headline: will it hit the Earth? And the answer was no, it won't. So don't even bother. You can answer the question, but don't make it as if, you know, it's possible, because at 0.0001%, it's just not going to happen. However, just last week, again, they were back, because this asteroid is on an orbit, and it comes back every 19 years. So in 19 years from now, lo and behold, it could hit the Earth. So NASA comes in and says, and so many times, no, it will not, or basically the chances of that, it would have to have some external perturbation of its orbit, which we don't predict, you know, can happen very easily. So therefore, the chances of a lot more things catastrophic happening are much higher. Well, NASA is an authority, but isn't it?
People don't trust or respect NASA anymore. I was at Cape Canaveral when they told us that, you know, they wouldn't. I would ask the FOIA if I wanted to find out what the temperature of the Challenger was at launch. I mean, nobody trusts any of these institutions anymore.
That's an awfully big broad statement.
I do not have any data on it, as a matter of fact. I have millions kinds of people who say that they won't do things that are clearly without any
about
danger.
NASA?
About
NASA. Millions of people
CNN,
who say they
NASA,
don't
NASA,
no, not NASA,
NASA,
NASA, NASA, NASA, NASA in general.
Well, I have hundreds of thousands of school teachers who every month go to the NASA websites. They trust NASA.
In Canada, there is more trust.
I think there's a lot of trust.
In Canada, there's more trust. And we've actually studied this. We've actually done surveys of Albertans. They're kind of Canadians, right? They're close. And we've looked at, and the number one trust is our university professors. Actually, number one trust.
We have similar surveys.
And the government is pretty high in Canada. I think it's much lower in the UK, much lower in the United States. But we have that trust. You know what's fascinating is the degree to which the public loses trust in university researchers if they get industry funding. So you are a university researcher, but you're getting industry funding. Little do they know, right, that virtually every biomedical. But yeah, so there's still a lot of trust. But the other problem is that a lot of these areas, like chiropractic, like natural, they have their own journals and they do their own studies and then they do their own aggregation of data, which complicates things even further. Who do you believe? And I've had the situation, I'm sure you have, Joe, too, where you've said homeopathy doesn't work, and then you get envelopes full of studies that say it does work. Right? So the story becomes very, 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 very difficult. And that's why things like the Cochrane Collaboration, like the association, they're all incredibly valuable, incredibly valuable.
The biggest thing that you have to battle is what these naturopaths, for instance, and chiropractors and psychics all have in common. They will sit for an hour and a half, and be absolutely fascinated by what you have to say. And listen only to you talk about yourself for an hour and a half. No professor will give you that amount of time. No doctor, no GP will give you that time. And certainly no specialist will give you anywhere near that amount of time. You'll get, like a few minutes, that's it. These people listen to them, and for that, they feel better the second they've walked out until they have to pay for the $700 worth of supplements at the end. But it's somebody who listens to them. That's one of the major attractions. They
Absolutely.
Listen to me.
Who's been to a naturopath? I've been to a naturopath. I went, and you described it exactly, including the bill at the end. I think I paid $450. I can't remember what it was, but it was for supplements and homeopathic and all these things.
You must have gotten a professional discount.
And I did feel great coming out. I mean, I love talking about myself.
I think we should let Julie be fantastic. Well, because after sitting on top of all that liquid hydrogen and perchlorate, you
well,
have trust
course,
in them.
Again, I apply that triple check rule almost everything. It's a professional information, and I bug my entire family with this, because I'm like, hey, did you like, are you the only one? But NASA, clearly, I don't think that everything that comes out of it is true necessarily. Nobody is infallible. But on a topic such as whether or not an asteroid is going to hit the Earth, I will trust NASA way more than I will trust no offense at all to those people who work in the media, because sometimes what I read in the newspaper has nothing to do with the reality, because people don't necessarily check their fact. What I don't like, or what makes me suspicious, is when I hear a study says, well, which study, when, how, conducted by whom, with whom, when, is it corroborated? But this is very annoying, a behavior, so my family says, so most people don't engage in that. We don't engage as, that's strange. Does that make any sense? Or I'm supposed to eat all these supplements and omega-3 and vitamin E and vitamin D's, and then because I'm being told this is good. People don't question, they just do it. Indeed. And so my question would be to the people who are interested in science education, so how do you prepare, especially the youth, to be a little bit more skeptical about life, be a little bit more critical, use their critical thinking, their sense of analysis. Sometimes, don't take everything for granted, but at the same time, you need to trust into something a little bit, right? So if NASA tells me that they've discovered salted water underneath the surface of Europa, a moon of Jupiter, I'm pretty sure that that's because they have that information somewhere.
The point I was making is there are very few agencies, organizations, or authorities in the United States that you could point to and say they are generally trusted. And that includes NASA.
No, and Americans don't trust the WHO. I mean, I saw a fascinating study. Yeah, the rest of the world
don't trust anybody.
Yeah. Well, Americans are a little unusual. They don't.
I mean, I've never heard that
people, but I'm an American, so I can say. I think part of the problem is getting people to understand what it takes to get scientists to come to a consensus about anything. I think there's a big there's a sort of easy temptation to think that it's just one person saying one thing, it's another person saying another thing. But if you explain to people, you know, how would you want to solve this problem? How would you want to find out if, say, climate change is real? And if you explain, well, what you did with your tax money is you hired a whole bunch of really smart people, the smartest people you could find. You made them compete with each other for a tiny amount of money for a period of about 50 years. You made sure that they were from every different part of the world, from every different political, religious spectrum. They're all over the place. They have nothing in common except that they're doing this one thing, and they came up with an answer. And it's one answer. And it's very hard to think of a reason why that answer wouldn't be correct, or at least the best explanation we have. All the alternatives involve weird conspiracy theories, right? And so I think that's a very common sense approach to solving any problem that anyone can get behind, but they don't actually know that this is how science works. They think it's like on Law and Order, where someone sits in an office and makes up a story and then convinces people that it's true, and then that's it.
Let's ask our two reporters about this, because, you know, one of the big bugaboos that I think most of us have about reporting is they, on the one hand this and on the other hand that, is that there's some controversial story. So reporters will go and seek out expert opinion on one side, seek out the expert opinion on the other side, write the story as if those were equal opposing views, whereas one side might be totally weighted more than the other.
Yeah, so I think the on the one hand, on the other hand, stories work for most things. They work for crime stories and justice stories and economic stories. I don't think we do them as often as people think in health and science. I think it happens. And it happens with simple things. But I think if you go to good sources of information in the media, you're going to get much more nuanced stories and more detailed stories. The difficulty we have is often that there's, in the science world, on the one hand, and on the other hand. So what's the beauty of quacks? The beauty of quacks is they give you a clear answer. Yes. Yes, this is the facts. And, you know, no, that sounds good. You go to a scientific society, well, yes, but, and then the but slants for half an hour. That's hard to cram into a sentence. So people want straight answers. So what I've seen over time is this a lot more skepticism, like Michael said. People are doubtful of everything, but they haven't replaced it with critical thinking. People used to be way too trusting when I started writing about health and science. Oh, yeah, okay, government said it, well, it's true. And it wasn't always true. And now I think we're at a, I hope we're in a pendulum period where now people, we're going to teach younger people to be more critical in their thinking and analysis, and things will even out more.
No. Well, you have an interesting question here. Does the mainstream media provide a properly balanced view? No, because it's trying to, newspapers are dying. They're trying to sell entertainment. They're trying to sell what's palatable to the masses. So, I mean, we come out with a story every day. I mean, one day coffee's good, one day coffee's bad, one day chocolate's good. We'll find something in there for everybody to find something to be happy about. And as you've mentioned, if someone likes what someone else represents, you're going to go along with that kind of thinking. So there isn't as much critical thinking anymore, and I think media is largely responsible for that. I mean, Wolf Blitzer goes on CNN, cites a theory, and everybody looks at him. He looks very authoritative, and they want to believe that that's true. They trust him, but then someone goes to Fox, and they trust the other guy. I mean, basically, people are lost. They don't know what to believe anymore.
I mean, you need, I'm totally not someone who believes on the one hand or the other hand. You need to be in fair and balanced. Many years ago, when I was starting as a reporter at the Washington Post, there was some huge AZT story. They'd approved it for some thing, I can't remember, it was so long ago. There was a guy from California, a right-wing lunatic, anti-gay guy called Henry Dandemeyer. And it was a huge story, and I was writing in it at 6 o'clock. My boss came up to me and said, "Where's your story?" And I said, "Well, I'm waiting for Dandemeyer to get back to me." And he just looked at me and said, "There are not two sides to every story. What is wrong with you?" Which was a major revelation for me at that time. But it's totally true. Sometimes there's 11 sides to a story, but there is also one side to a story.
But when it comes to the one side, I think the media is tempted and really wants to go to the two sides of the story because we want to sell papers and we want to have an audience. But I'm sure that if we had what you were suggesting, Dr. Joe, and what you're suggesting, that there's only one side. In the case of Semmelweis, the only side was that obviously the doctors know what they're doing and the midwives don't. That would have been the story, and it turned out to be wrong. It turned out that the midwives knew what they were doing and the doctors didn't. So you don't know which one it's going to be, where it's like, well, you shouldn't even talk to the other side. Don't dignify it with a response. Because what happens when you do that, you're helping the other side get more adherence because they'll present it, you're afraid to even debate. They're so unsure of what they're thinking, they're afraid to even debate. Like in the case I just asked you before, to debate with the naturopaths, because you know more than I do, you know certainly more than the general public knows, and you'll be able to refute what she says very well and very matter-of-factly as being correct.
It won't matter.
Yeah.
I never debate those people because it's a religion and they don't want to hear facts.
Well, but it's also, I don't think it's the job of the media or the schools to sort of play out scientific controversies. I think it's their job to present the consensus if there is one. And if it's wrong, it's wrong. The downside of the controversy, you see it in the creationism debate. They've given up long ago trying to establish a scientific creationism. Their goal is to create the appearance of a controversy. Every time there's a debate, every time there's a textbook that has a sticker on it, they're sort of winning, not because they have a better argument, because they've sort of just created doubt in people's minds.
So the tool we were talking before, Julie was mentioning before, you know, what can we do to change that? I said this before at a previous panel. I think our generation is lost. People have their ideas. People have their sources of authority, whether it's Jenny McCarthy and the vaccine issue or Dr. Oz or whatnot. And you know, the key is the future and it's the children. And I've said this before, you have to add a fourth R to the three R, which is reasoning. And if you don't teach critical thinking at an early age, I think it's too late. I think by the time you've formed your biases and your preferences in terms of your sources of information, at that point, it's almost too late to go back and say, well, you know, how can I look at this a different way? So I remember when Ben Goldacre was on one of the panels a couple years ago, he was talking about in England how they're starting now to integrate that in some of the primary school programs, giving them experiments and teaching them a little bit about controlled studies versus non-controlled. And I thought that was great. Now, I'm sure that isn't, unfortunately, the norm anywhere, but that would be the first step, I think, towards changing what we're talking about now.
And that's what you can do a lot better.
Not NCSC specifically, but we are supporting the Next Generation Science Standards, which are the new model science standards that we're hoping more states will adopt. They're going to be extremely challenging because they take the content of science and the nature of science and they try to weave them together in the same fashion that you were talking about. So there's organizations like the Fordham Foundation that's having a fit because you're leaving out all these facts that we used to teach. The whole idea of depth over breadth is something that a lot of people can't get their heads around. But we have Google. We don't need the facts, right? Yes. We can look facts up. What students really need to learn is the basics of how do you think like a scientist? How do scientists come up with their decisions? The sort of nature of science stuff that is supposed to be being taught, but I think by and large is not being taught.
Maybe that's what we thought about more, because I think it's very much analogous to reading. It's totally unnatural for people.
Oh, yeah, totally. I agree.
Like, completely objective.
It's like the way
and it takes a lot of practice. I mean, reading takes 4 years of just concentrated practicing, controlling your eye movements, bringing in the signals to your brain, interpreting them fast. But once you learn to do that, you have a lot of opportunities you didn't have before you, economic opportunities. And I think the science...
I love that analogy. Oh, I'm in the steel.
Right.
I think if everyone was forced in America, at least I don't know the Canadian education system, I'm sorry, but... Kids should be forced to take some form of statistics as, at the worst, at high school. I mean, my daughter took a physics class. She's about as likely to become a physicist as she is to become an astronaut, and she's not likely to become an astronaut. I would have so much rather just, like, have kids learn, on the one hand, on the other hand, what a probability is. Because when people talk about, gee, I don't know if this is safe or not, they don't say, well, compared to what? Or what are the alternatives? Or is it a risk of 1 in 7 or 1 in 70 million? And just basic statistics would not solve everything, but it would help. And we don't get that in America.
Well, they don't even get basic sciences, never mind basic statistics.
Well, it's only science because this reaches absolutely everything.
Yes,
it's the entire society that would benefit from that. Right. So, yes, indeed, a class, I'm dreaming one day of seeing that all over the places, a class in that would be in one class about teaching critical thinking, because it can be taught, common sense, and I'd add to that cell phone etiquette.
I would fully agree to try to build statistics very early on in the education system, but you know, until that happens, probably mass media do have an opportunity to help a lot. So I don't think that just giving one-sided stories or only multiple-sided stories would solve the problem. And most scientific statements have some level of certainty and some level of uncertainty. So the question is, could one convey the exact level of certainty and uncertainty? And in some cases, smoking kills people, HIV causes AIDS, evolution theory, it's certainty going to 100%. In other cases, it would be very interesting theories that are 1% likely to be true, but you know, if they are true, it's very interesting to know about, because who knows, maybe in a few years that would be a new scientific discipline that will change the world. And people should know that this is a 1% chance that this is true. And I think the mass media could convey that. You know, they could give both sides or 11 sides about that new theory and say that we're in the 1% range currently. It's very exciting. Keep track with what's happening in that field because it may affect you down the road. Don't change your life right now. I mean, don't sell your house or move to a different planet or whatever. But it's interesting to hear about. This is something that's not happening, and I think it could happen. When you see sports stories, for example, in newspapers.
But remember, it's not the job of the media to educate people, right? It's the job of the media to sell newspapers or to sell magazines.
And it's sports stories and newspapers.
Also, we live in celebrity culture. I mean, let's face it. I mean, nobody cares about a story they read by a scientific expert. I mean, a shaman like Dr. Oz or somebody will go on the air and say something about blueberries, and it just appeals right to the core of what this cures all diseases.
The only thing he says that's right.
What I'd say, and that's right, but like, but whatever, but the point is that's what people want to believe in. It's so easy, and they're the stars. People have such ADD anyway. All they want is one little pearl of wisdom from a Tom Cruise or
Oprah. No, that's not always. I wrote 10,000 words about Dr. Oz, and I've been doing this really long.
I like those words.
And I got an amazing response, and not just positive, but people do pay attention. It isn't, you don't only have to write 400 words. Now, the problem in America is I don't know of any, you know, the New Yorker lets me run around and spend time and money to do this. There are not many places left to do. So you are reduced to 400 words, and it's really hard to be in any way sophisticated in a few paragraphs. But I do think I am always surprised by how many people read the complex science stories and seem to care about them. I don't think it's true that they don't care. I think it's true that they're not being serviced properly.
The only, going back to the issue of science education, which of course is important, the one thing that, and just to go back to vaccines, the one thing that, and we have done so much research, the people who distrust vaccines the most tend to be the most educated.
Yeah,
and,
absolutely.
I mean, the more graduate degrees they have, the more likely they are to question vaccines. So, I think obviously we have to teach science and people hopefully will understand it better, but there also does need to be a better filter between what gets covered, you know, some sort of arbiter of what's getting covered, and then some sort of analysis of, you know, is the NVIC, National Vaccine Information Center, which is, you know, anti-vaccine, versus, say, what the Institute of Medicine says. I mean, how do you weigh two clearly not equal voices?
It's not about the science. I mean, assuming the vaccine issue is comparable to the evolution issue, the climate change issue. Those are the two issues I know more about. Certainly with the evolution issue, you will not solve this problem by shoveling more science on top. If it were about the science, we could all go home.
Right.
We win.
Right.
We got the fossils. We got everything. We got the molecules.
We got
the whole world. Living things said common ancestors, full stop. We can quit. But it's not about the science. It's about trust, and it's about consequences. Who do you trust who's carrying the message, And what are the consequences if the other guy's right? If I'm a creationist, the consequences if that Eugenie Scott lady is right are really bad. That means there's no God, there's no Bible, I lose salvation, there's no moral rudder, I lose all my friends and my whole social support. What's the probability that my explaining the Cambrian explosion is going to convince somebody to just jettison all of that information? Zero. And you could say that, you know, it's comparable examples for climate change if you're a conservative politician. What matters is the person who brings the contrary point of view, someone who is trusted, which we have talked about, and we've got some ideas about the importance of trust, but also the consequences. And the two are related. So from my standpoint, as somebody who's trying to, you know, get evolution into the school, keep evolution in the schools, get it into the schools, evangelical Christians who accept evolution are the most important people in this whole controversy for me. Because they are trusted individuals, they have heard the good news, they come from the same cultural and social...
Is that most of the people?
No, that's a very tiny slice of evangelical Christians, but they're extremely important. Just like it's a tiny slice of conservative political people who accept climate change, but they're really important for that reason. It's because the evangelicals who accept evolution can assuage the consequences, shall we say. Okay, I'm still a good Christian, they would say. I've still heard the good news. I'm faithful to Jesus, et cetera, et cetera. I'm just like you, but let me show you how I resolve the ideological problems, the religious problems, and accept the science. And the only person who can make that sale is not a non-believer. The only person who can make that sale is somebody who speaks the same
language.
Well,
in politics, it's the wedge strategy, right, where you go and you find people who have the different view within that group.
We all use that strategy.
Right. And
I just explained a wedge strategy from my standpoint.
Exactly.
My wedge strategy is finding the evangelical Christians to carry that message. Wedges are something everybody uses.
Bill said something that is extremely important, and it relates to God. The new gods are these celebrities. And whatever they say, and all the information on earth, and it's nothing to do with what you would lose otherwise, these are the people you in fact worship. In other words, you don't go to church or synagogue or mosque anymore. These are the people you worship. These are the people you read about. These are the people whose lives you emulate. They're the new gods on Mount Olympus. And if one of the gods on Mount Olympus says something, it must be true, because they are. You like them much more than you like any scientist. And they're better looking than the scientists.
And they have TV shows.
Celebrity spokespeople.
Yeah.
We'd love one. Anybody know?
There's some Kardashians.
There are some. Matt Damon is a spokesman for water, and he's done amazing things. I mean, it is possible to find people.
Alan Alda has done great things.
Oh, yeah,
science.
True.
Amanda Pete, I mean, you know, there are people who do the right things. Mm-hmm. Just...
They're
very famous people who
don't. Well, Oz is the most dangerous, I think, because some of the stuff he says is right incredible.
Yeah, he is very, very scary.
But what's scary is he's not stupid.
No, that's why he's scary. Yeah. He's a highly educated, sophisticated, and incredibly...
Would be a lot easier to dismiss someone like that.
Pleasant guy.
Yeah.
I mean, you know, if he was a creep and the reason he's so powerful, the reason Andy Weil, the reason these guys matter is because there's sometimes a grain of truth to what they say, and they bring a veneer of education.
And that's exactly.
The super quacks are easy to dismiss.
Do you think he would be pleasant to you now if you met?
Yeah. I mean, he internally would want me dead. I will say, I...
Would he be pleasant to you? You haven't cut his income at all?
No, I mean, because... I've been writing for New Yorker for 15 years, and I have never written a story about any person ever, zero times, who has not communicated with me afterwards, except for Dr. Oz. Sometimes they say bad things, most of the times they say okay things, but no one except Dr. Oz has ever said nothing. And I think the reason is because what I said in that piece was true, so he couldn't attack it, and... He just felt like the best thing to do was slink away, and he's right. But it's interesting to me.
Or even if, this is the utterly dismal theorem, even if millions of people read The New Yorker, there's more than that number of people in the United States who are watching the cable shows where he appears.
But he cares deeply about that, or he wouldn't have done it. I mean, I wrote a book, which I tracked.
I'm sorry.
done a profile, let me write about him. Oh. He cares what the New Yorker says. Uh-huh. I wrote a book in which I trashed Oprah, his patron saint, and he read that book and he knew that before he let me hang around with him for weeks. Mm. He thought that he could win me with his charming personality, which is charming. I'd be glad to have a lunch with him. I wouldn't even mind him taking my heart out of my chest. But I just don't want to listen to him talk about something. Yeah.
And put something back. I mean, otherwise I can line you up with some Aztecs.
No, I watched him do heart surgery. He's good at it. It's just it's all the other stuff that is so scary.
One of the questions here says, how does the, again, mainstream media, but the personal experience, I live 17 years of my life in a place called Houston, Texas.
Oh, you poor thing.
Yeah.
And it is actually very fascinating because we, NASA, where I was working, is about 40 miles south of downtown Houston. So it's in a suburb somewhere. But what was fascinating, this was the mecca of top-end aerospace with...
Oh, yeah.
20,000 people working in the vicinity, all extremely brilliant, dedicated, critical thinking, name it all. But then there was also the mecca of complete belief in things that I had never seen anywhere else, including going on Sundays, and I did go there to the mega churches in downtown, closer to downtown Houston, where there are tens of thousands of people who listen to a beautiful entertainer, somebody speaking on a mic with grandiloquent act, and of course he's doing miracle and saving another, and we'd say in French, "Lève toi et marche," stand up and walk, and they do, and then people chanting. I mean, it is an unbelievable thing to see. And then they go, and many of them are in the technical business. So I never was able to reconcile that. Somehow, why is it that nowadays more than any other day, when access to information is so easy, that you have a lot of still very, very strong faith and belief, or I don't know how to explain it. It's the fact that they are so strongly attached to those things that can't be proven.
So,
look at Francis.
It's not about proving things. I mean, you have, this is going to come out wrong. You have just made an argument from ignorance, okay? Religion is not about factuality and empirical evidence. Religion is about emotion. Religion is about meaning. The people were at that congregational service at that big mega church because religion provides meaning to their life. Science doesn't provide meaning. Science is a way of understanding the natural world, a really good one. My humanist philosophy draws a lot from science, but it's not the same thing as science. My humanist philosophy gives my life meaning, just like Christianity gives their lives meaning, but neither of them is science. Science does something else for people. Religion is
what many of them were working in a scientific world, and then
right. I'm sure many of them were businessmen. And many of them were ballet dancers, and many of them were garbage collectors or whatever. It doesn't matter what you do in your day job.
Just a comment.
It's about meaning.
I think it's one of the original Mercury 7 astronauts, I forget which one, but who orbited the Earth, but he actually went on a mission to, I think it was Mount Ararat, looking for
notes.
This is Edgar Mitchell. That's who we're talking about.
Yeah, he's special.
Yeah.
So, he's one of our
specials. It's about meaning. It's not about empirical evidence.
But it's also here you have someone who was trained in science as much as anyone can be trained, and yet he believed in UFOs and every other piece of nonsense. Did you ever meet him?
No. He doesn't hang out in the
astronaut group. That's not quite the same thing, because UFOs is that is something that's either true or false. It's something that you can test empirically. And I think in this case, this guy was not applying the kind of thinking that he would apply in his normal scientific reasoning, because it's pretty clear that, you know, UFOs don't hold water, so to speak, if you actually apply some critical thinking to them. But the supernatural, so to speak, the existence of God, what God does, whether God can perform miracles and heal people and so forth.
I would say that
that's a different thing from science.
The aerospace business in Houston, yeah. Texas, that was also applicable to climate change.
Oh, yeah.
So it's not just
but it's
religion.
A different ideology.
It's just, it looks like sometimes, and that I think we're all guilty of that, we take the facts that pleases us, and we don't. We're like that. That is why sometimes also in almost every single public venue, certainly around where I live, if you walked in, there's always a television, if not five televisions on, and it was almost irrevocably Fox News in where I live. So they're getting one point of view, because that's one point of view, but they're not interested. And I think it does play. They're not interested in hearing the other point of view. And then at the primary school my son went to, when I was kind of shopping around, I found a teacher there to ask a few questions about school. And when finally, he's going into kindergarten, so I'm not asking about science teaching. But she said to me, to reassure me, she says, oh, we're not controversial here. We don't teach evolution, and we don't teach anything else. And I'm like, okay, that's reassuring. Let's keep them ignorant.
There was an article in the Times, I think, a few years ago about a guy who was a young Earth creationist and a geologist. And, you know, geology is all about digging down through billions of years of soil, and according to young Earth creationism, the Earth is 6,000 years old, right? And he just explained it sort of like, well, I think about these two things in different ways. I think about the sort of process of writing a scientific article as a game that I play, and I try and make all the facts be internally coherent, but I don't really believe them, and I do my religious thing at home. And I think that's true to some extent of everybody. I don't think the human mind really tries to make a coherent story about the world. It sort of uses different approaches in different ways. You can't get out of bed in the morning without using some variation of the scientific method, right? You have to look at the evidence around you and think about, you know, am I lying on my back over, you know. And you interpret that and you make a decision, but you don't necessarily do that with every combination of facts you have in your mind. There was another study where they asked MIT physics students some basic questions that were applied questions. If I'm driving a car and I throw a ball out, which way does it go? You know, things like this. And they often got them wrong, but they could solve the equations. They just had to put the two things together in your mind. So I completely believe that you could work at NASA and do all this technical stuff, the physics, the equations, and then go home and believe in Fox News and all this sort of non-scientific nonsense that you might get in a megachurch, and have no problem keeping them both straight in your mind most of the time.
I think it's very difficult to eliminate nonsense. I mean, it's so powerful and so penetrant in society. And the question is mostly, how can we live with some nonsense but not having it invade areas that we need to have some serious decision making, and mm-hmm. you know, things could affect health, well-being, outcomes for society and the world. I don't see that I have an answer for that, but I think that some tolerance to nonsense, provided that it does not come into conflict and debate with what we know about science, should probably be okay. But once it gets into crossing that path,
here's a utopian suggestion. Even amongst doctors, I mean, we're trained obviously in critical thinking as part of our curriculum in medical school. We take epidemiology courses, statistics courses. So, you know, from an early time, we know how to read an article and then hopefully determine whether the research is valid or not. And yet, once we finish, many times we are bombarded with a lot of articles, and some of them contradictory, and it's difficult sometimes, unless you specialize in that field, to really know, you know, which are the better studies and which are not. And so I know in my specialty they've now started grading articles. You literally get the journal, you get the article, and you have a little triangle at the end, and it's rated 1 to 5, 1 being the least authoritative, meaning it came from a single authority, and then 5 being a, you know, double-blind controlled study, and, you know, everything between retrospective studies. So my utopian suggestion is, why not, and I don't know who the first of the media would take this on, but why not do the same thing to the articles that are published and rank them and rate them and say, okay, this article is a 1. It's just, you know, hearsay and a little bit of anecdote and a little bit of authoritative information. And this one's a 5. This one is actually a double-blind controlled study that came from, you know, top
journal from Lancet or from Science or something
like that. Actually, the website that does exactly that.
Yeah, yeah. It would be great if Google did that. So, you know, going back to what Michael was saying about, you know, you look up Google, and instead of just getting the algorithm, you actually get a little ranking next to it.
They have and are trying to do something like that, but it's kind of complicated. They would love to be able to have people have the kind of trust in their results that we're all talking about. It's really difficult to do.
Sure it is. And then you have to ask, you know, who's going to be doing the ranking on top of it. But, you know, it would be a start. I mean, it would be a start to at least tell people that there is a difference between information from this source and information from that source.
But, I mean, you mentioned, like, my favorite example is that if you do a search on vaccines on Google, you'll get the NIH and the CDC and the National Center for Vaccine Information, which looks like a fantastic organization with great graphics and lots of studies, and it's a complete lunatic anti-vaccine front by this well-known anti-vaccine woman. If you don't know much about this stuff and you're genuinely interested in finding out, it's really hard to immediately know that this is crap. And so that kind of thing, I think, could be...
Well, maybe you don't have to immediately know, but you do have to examine.
There are some great sources. The one in the UK, I'm blanking on the name, Joe, that's fantastic. And they do critique of all the media.
Sense About Science?
There's Sense About Science, which is also great, and there's another one. But I have a question for the media. The one side, you know, there's this side of the story and that side of the story. That bugs me. But what drives me absolutely insane are the stories in there every week. There'll be some in the Globe and Mail, usually in Lifetime, there'll be my Edmonton Journal has one, and it'd be a non-critical story about some alternative medicine or some kind of bogus diet, completely uncritical, presented, there's one I was talking about this morning about how taking cold baths will shed you of any of your soreness after a workout. Not a shred of evidence on that. How can the, you know, I know it's an entertainment industry, that's why they do it. That's why we have these kinds of stories. But when you don't, as Michael said, when you get that from a good newspaper, you know, it's not the National Enquirer, what's the public supposed to do? I mean, it drives me insane. You guys must see these things. It must drive
so that's what did it.
So you know me well. But, I mean, you get these all the time. And there's no critical analysis whatsoever. And there's even often a recommendation at the bottom what patients should do.
You know, I wish I could say there's a lot of thought that goes into that, but it's filling up a hole in a newspaper. And I think you would concur on this level. What happens is you've got a whole big space and then something, I don't know, an ad falls out of a story that was going to be used. And throw in anything. And basically... And it doesn't hurt to take it cold. But that's just it. I mean, you actually think that somebody is like a group of editors are sitting around pondering, well, I think this is important for humanity. They don't give a shit.
There was a story that came out not that long ago, and I actually looked. Yeah, where you lied and you put snails on your face. It was everywhere. It was everywhere and had some pseudoscientific language on it. Sure. No critical analysis.
And more grotesque.
There's a very simple formula.
It has nothing to do with any kind of logic.
In cosmetic medicine, the more expensive and the more crazy it sounds, the better it will sell. I had a friend call me from a cosmetics conference or public conference in Vegas, literally call me from the exhibition floor saying, hey, listen, they're selling the skin cream with diamond dust.
Oh, yeah.
At $1,000.
I would have been to that spot.
It would have been $10. They wouldn't have called me, but $1,000.
Can you tell? No, but there is a logic to it. I disagree with Bill, but it's just to fill in the space. There is a logic to it. The newspapers, I think they still do starches. They see who reads what. Okay, and in terms of who's going to read that story about this diamond, they're all going to read it. And there's going to be a huge reaction, and the ads next to it are going to do extremely well because far more people read that page. That's what the public wants, and the media in many cases, it's not a matter of that they're deciding this is what you should have. They find out what really works and what doesn't, and a dry scientific article full of facts is not going to work, is not going to sell. And they're in the business like a bakery sells bread. We're in the business of selling newspapers. We're getting people to listen to the radio for this many minutes longer. If I say that the psychic is going to tell you, you know, what's going to happen in 2014, everybody's going to stay. Even the people who think she's a complete idiot are still going to stay past the commercial to hear, just to get, they don't believe it, she's obviously a fraud, but still, I'm curious, what is it? They're going to do that. It's just like...
I hate to be put in the position of defending the profession I've spent my life in, but I'll give it a shot. I worked at the Washington Post and the New York Times for many years, and then the New Yorker, and I admit those are unusual places. But I've been acquainted with other people at other places, and I know many, many editors and many, many writers who would never just throw something in to fill a hole or because it might sell. I mean, I know that happens. But you also have to look at the landscape out there. Are we talking about newspapers, or are we talking about websites? Are we talking about the Huffington Post, which just aggregates shit for a living? That's what it does.
But
I mean, are we talking about real newspapers?
And how many hits does it have, the Huffington? I agree with you.
But I just think we should be a little more specific about who we're saying is just filling space.
I think I've seen the New York Times cover every fat diet. And Dean Ornish,
I worked there
just like the others.
I never felt pressure or saw pressure or heard an editor suggest we should ever publish anything unless we felt satisfied that it was true, which still means it could have been true.
How many articles have they published on Dr. Atkins' diet?
I'm not here to talk about a specific place, but I am here to say that they are not the problem.
I will come to the New Yorker's defense, because we've actually tried to analyze other media. And when the New Yorker does something on Atkins, they will generally do this side and that side.
I said the New York Times.
I think you have been...
The New Yorker?
Oh, not the New Yorker, the New York Times. But let me give you an example from Canada. So, Maclean's magazine, right? Cover of Maclean's, huge story, Sidney Crosby chiropractic cure. Remember that?
Yeah.
And it was, I still get emails about it. I mean, that's incredible to me that that got that kind of coverage. So, Michael, was a story saying that it was, what was it, curing Crosby? Is that what it was called?
Right.
You know, incredible.
That's my point entirely.
He's a big deal. I love the fact that you do not know Sidney Crosby. I love
it.
That's like saying, hey, Tom Brady is a
star in Canadian hockey. But that's the point entirely.
Yeah,
biggest star of Canadian hockey.
But that wasn't filling space, to Michael's point.
No,
that was Plains Magazine.
That's
made
the
a
other point. It's celebrity culture. Like,
absolutely.
Because Sidney Crosby adheres to this. Every kid in the country, and by the way, every sports team in the country now has a chiropractor.
Well, Lance Armstrong had a chiropractor.
Yeah. But no, but they all, like 10 years ago, I don't know how many did today, every single team has got a chiropractor, and goes to, that's the whole point.
In retrospect, I would argue if Lance spent more time with chiropractors and less with drug dealers, things might have been better for the world.
You know, there's another issue, both with radio and with the print media, in advertising and what is accepted in advertising. The Gazette will have half-page ads of total nonsense, of weight control crap and chiropractic crap.
Tiny words somewhere in the corner that nobody sees. So sometimes those ads look like they're an article.
Oh, absolutely.
In the newspaper.
And Tommy will attest to the kind of ads that have been run on CJ.
Yeah, I wake up every morning to the same ad, like advertorial.
It's unbelievable.
It's very difficult for them.
Yes.
It's hard to see
that. The green coffee that is, of course, will make any other diet obsolete by just ordering it. You don't even have to take it. You just send the money, and right away you lose weight before it even arrives. That's how miraculous.
Well, you've lost the weight of the money in your
life. Yes, it's so miraculous. Apparently, it's very difficult to tell them that they're a fraud. Like you say, what would you have to give them a reason why you're not accepting it? Right? And so there can be all kinds of legal issues. That's what they tell us when we all go to complain. Why are you running this blatantly?
Well, of course, they're very careful with the words.
Yes, that's
right. You put in enough mays and maybes, and legally they protect themselves.
Well, they could actually put in, this is a fraud at the end. By the way, this is a fraud.
And
send 1995 to, it would hardly make a dent.
Send 2248 and we'll send you two.
Yeah.
That's the point with those products. I went to a symposium in the U.S., and it was about the words that they use to just get around the False Advertising Act, and the fact that if you say may or could or whatever, keeps it in the cosmeceutical realm. As soon as you say will make you younger, will get rid of wrinkles, it becomes a drug. And if it's a drug, it means that then and it needs to go through the through exactly. So So they're very, very careful that way. But again, that would be a very simple thing to, I mean, simple. It'd be complicated to get out to the masses, but it'd be a simple thing to differentiate. And it'd be very easy to tell people, whether it's on radio or in advertising, that if it's not a drug, it doesn't have any actual effect. It's that simple. If it's a drug, it has to have an effect on your body.
Every single ad in the United States for one of these supplements says this has not been approved by the FDA as a treatment, a prevention, or a cure for anything. And you have to ask yourself, if something isn't a prevention, it's not a treatment, and it's not a cure, what the hell is it?
It doesn't stop any of this.
I mean, yes.
The FDA doesn't like it. It's seen as a selling point.
Yeah, I was just going to say that.
It's a selling point.
Yeah. It's cutting edge.
Of course, they're in league with Big Pharma. Of course, they don't want. This is what they don't. I mean, that's why Trudeau called his book what companies don't want you to know. What could be more appealing than that?
It's placebo.
And by the way, that is a title for something. For anything is unbelievable. When I give speeches, they say, "What's the topic of your? What's your subject going to be?" I should just put this down. What the politicians don't want you to know. It'll be a packed house. And then I'll fill in whatever I was going to say anyway.
Well, the things NASA doesn't tell you.
Yeah, that's right. Yeah.
But you're right about the selling point with stem cell therapies. The FDA has said, we're not going to approve these. And they actually put that now on their websites. And it's a plus,
and
right? This is so cutting edge. This is so, the FDA.
The FDA approved drugs. I love the American ads. Like the side effects, I forget it. Every single disease imaginable might,
Did you see the study that came out that said that advertising the side effects increases sales?
Really?
Yeah, because it obviously sounds pretty powerful here. Right. This is,
There was Shots and Rumors is this humor thing in the New Yorker, and sometimes it's funny and sometimes it's not. But a few years ago, maybe 10, Steve Martin wrote a Shots and Rumors that was literally just a list of this can cause hundreds of side effects. I mean, just list after list of side effects. And it was actually hilarious, but it was all just taken from different drug ads. I mean, every possible thing that could happen to a human was in that story.
What you want is to integrate the critical thinking throughout all courses.
Yeah.
That's much more effective than just teaching the class.
How do you do that?
Just like teaching the nature of science, the best way to teach nature of science is to integrate it throughout the course. If you have the lecture or two at the beginning of the class on the nature of science, kids doze off right away. If while you're teaching the science, you say, and the reason why we know this is because it was tested by this, that, or the other thing, then students pick it up much better. And I think we should do critical thinking the same way.
How would the religious right react to
They love science. They'd be delighted in it.
But critical thinking implies questioning religion.
Not necessarily.
Well, it can. It can. It can lead to that. It can see, the kid can come home and say, If the Earth is really 6,000 years old, then how come they found fossils that are 6,000 years old?
There's a difference between the fact claims that a religion makes and the spiritual claims, so to speak. What is really important, even to the religious right, by and large, is the spiritual claims. But the religious right is an interesting entity just in and of themselves. The bigger set is conservative Christians, who are not all politically right, remember. There's a lot of discussion that goes on, even in conservative Christian theology, about the role of questioning and how students or children's faith will be stronger if they question and so forth. And there's also a lot of divergence of opinion within people who call themselves fundamentalists and people who call themselves evangelicals. It's not a one-size-fits-all kind of thing.
I think we might run into trouble is that, well, at least in my sort of fantasy about what a critical thinking course would be like, part of it would be looking at how the anti-science arguments are so identical from one field to the next. The anti-climate change arguments are transplanted anti-evolution arguments. And what they start to look like is arguments against using science as a way of knowing or incorporating evidence into your thinking. And that probably starts to sound a bit like faith to people who are sensitized to that sort of thing. I wonder if the religious right would react negatively to that.
That's not been my experience. I don't find that religious conservatives are anti-science. I don't think I don't. It's not been my experience that Americans in general are anti-science, and in fact, there's plenty of survey research showing that science has a really good press. We really, really like science, and we scientists are right up there next to firemen in terms of respected professions and stuff. So it's not like people are going around hating science. The issue more is I forget where I'm going with this, but I don't think it's an anti-science movement. I really don't. I think there are these sciences that we don't like, and this science that I don't like, but science in general is really great.
Right. But, Julia, also, go ahead.
I mean, one of the factors that plays into this also is conspiracy theories. I mean,
we're good at that.
You know, anytime you disagree with the mainstream scientists, they're all being bought off by industry, or they're being paid out, or they have some financial incentive, they're getting grants for it, whatever, and don't trust them because they're biased because that's how they earn their living or whatever. I don't know how you fight that, but there's people who claim that the statement that 97% of climate scientists agree that climate change is caused by humans, that's not true. Like, this is way off. Like, this is a big lie or whatever.
I think they've gone way beyond saying that it's not true. They're just wondering where the money's going. They're arguing the science less and less. And saying, well, how are you going to fix it?
There's a large variability. There's the denying it, the saying it's not caused by humans, the saying the people who say we can't do anything about it, even though it's probably caused by humans.
Well, it's actually a lot of the people who do believe in what the scientists have said 10 years ago that it's too late. It's absolutely too late 10 years ago. So a lot of the public has said, well, we believed you. You said the scientists said that. We believe you 100%. And you said 10 years ago, Gordon Brown said at Copenhagen, if there's no agreement, then anything done after that would be, he's trying to frighten everybody into doing something. And it was too late. So then people, well, if it was too late 10 years ago, what are going to do this now?
It's an electric switch that you turn on and off. It's gradations. And the more we...
And he was right.
Right. But if he was right, well, then there's no point in doing anything about it. It's over. That said, we can move on to something else.
And, you know, but I mean, I'm actually not a pessimist,
but the scientific community is a little bit of a culprit of its own... because of the fact of the nature of science itself, it's imprecise. You know, there's a range in which something's going to happen, and a lot of people are comfortable with that, but others are not. The latest report that just came out 2 weeks ago where they say, yes, of course, we're not debating whether or not the planet is warming up, but we're not sure if we're going to get 0.5 degree or 7 in length. So, of course, the public's going to say, well, gosh, you guys know anything?
No, but
it is a nature. But that's the way it was reported on the CBC radio. That if you listen to the way they reported that report, is that the scientists, well, they were out there in left field, not too sure about what's going to happen. That's not going to help the debate itself. Because the point is that it's warming up.
But it sounds like what they were doing is actually approaching it in a very useful fashion. I mean, a way that I often talk about the content of science is that there are visual aid, there are core ideas of science that scientists are really convinced about. Heliocentrism is here to stay. You know, nobody's really out there arguing that the sun goes around the earth, that planets go around the sun. We're really convinced of that. That's solid. Living things have common ancestors. That's pretty solid. I know, but I'm talking about today. Mm-hmm. What have you done for us lately? This is today. Okay, but around the core ideas of science is the frontier of science. That's where we're arguing about, is it going to be 2 degrees or 3 degrees? Is the ocean going to rise 3 feet or 6 feet? Those are the details of science, and some of those are going to be right, some of those are going to be wrong. But whether the detail is right or wrong doesn't affect the core idea that the planet is warming. That is really solid. We all agree on that. And I think there's a very useful... And then the third one is the fringe. Okay, that's the kind of stuff we really like to talk about. The ideas that scientists really aren't spending any time on, and, you know, because, generally speaking, they violate a core idea. So nobody, you know, you can find a lot of wonderful opportunities for investment in free energy on the Internet. Physicists aren't investing in those because they're perpetual motion machines, right? Perpetual motion machines violate the core principles of thermodynamics, which is why it's a fringe idea rather than a frontier idea. if we can distinguish, and maybe this is something that, that journalists could help with, although I admit it's not your job to help educate the public, it's your job to sell newspapers. But if you can distinguish between what are the core ideas that scientists agree upon and the ideas that you do want to have, you know, on the one hand, on the other hand, the ideas that you do want to say, scientist A says this and scientist B says this, it's still up in the air.
You know, science is held to a higher standard than almost anything else. You have one biox, and right away, it's the whole pharmaceutical industry that's corrupt.
I wrote about. Can I just trash scientists for a moment? Because then I will throw in journalists with them. Because
equal opportunity.
Ever since Watson and Crick made this discovery about a helix, we have been curing cancer with genetics. We have been solving every problem with different discoveries for years. We have taken. There's a mouse study that cures Parkinson's disease. We hype everything, and by we, I mean the press, but also many, many, many researchers. And that is part of our problem. People can hear it like 8,000 times, and when they don't, gee, you know, cancer still seems to be a problem, and so does Parkinson's disease, and so does diabetes. What were you people talking about?
I couldn't agree more.
What about life expectancy? What about the fact that
I'm not arguing that we haven't achieved amazing things. We have.
Well, there was the antibiotics took us from 40 years to 60 years, and everything else has been incremental. But
I'm not talking about the facts of where science has taken us, which is remarkable. I'm talking about what people say.
I couldn't agree with Mike
more. Things too much.
And Mike, we studied this. This is an area that, and I have this great slide. You've heard me present on this before. This great slide where I have covers of Time magazine saying, genetics, the future is now. Genetics, the future is now. Genetics, the future is now. And I have 71, 81. It's ridiculous. The hype, stem cell research, same thing. And it's, I couldn't agree more. And the pressure, but to be fair, I think it's a systemic problem. The pressure on scientists now to produce, and there, it's more pressure. Now you have to commercialize. You have to get in the clinic faster and faster. And it touches on your work, John, right? It creates this pressure to have animal studies that look more efficacious than they probably are. I couldn't agree more. And we actually did a study of how genetic discoveries are represented. It was way back in 2004 and published in CMAJ. And we actually found that the hype did not come from the journalists. The hype came from the scientific community. And the more a metric of hype, the more a predictor of hype is. Is a scientist quoted in the study? Because if a scientist isn't quoted, the journalists are pretty good about going to the back to the article. But if a scientist says something, it's fair game. And so that was the predictor of hype.
That's exactly what I was saying. Is that science is held to a much higher standard. So when you say that genomics is going to be the answer, and it isn't, then of course science gets blamed.
Absolutely.
Whereas the quacks can say anything that they want, and there's no blame. The homeopaths have been ranting about the same nonsense for 200 years, and yet nobody blames them. But science,
it's not true. You might blame them. It's a strategy to promise more than what we can really deliver. So I think if we cut back on conveying the uncertainty that we have about what we can do, what we have achieved, what are our estimates, what are the treatment effects, whether it's 0.5 to 7 degrees or 3 to 6, the uncertainty that we have, this will really get back to us down the road. I mean, if one prediction or one claim or something that seemed to be effective is downturned, or you have a story like Vioxx, then the whole edifice will collapse, because we have conveyed a picture that we know everything, we can promise everything, we're very powerful. And that's not really science. Then we're adopting the same kind of messaging that all the anti-science or non-scientific groups are adopting. They're very good at making big claims. I think we should be very good at making accurate claims and precise claims and claims that carry the right amount of uncertainty.
And there's
a lot of uncertainty. We just say so. We just don't know, and we're struggling to find out.
The nature of science is more, and Julie was getting at this before, is more probabilistic than it is deterministic, and most people are more comfortable when you can actually say with some certainty that it will happen. If we see a range that's from 0.5 to 7 degrees and we have a probability attached to it, as scientists, we're willing to accept that, and we're willing to understand what the consequences are. But most people in the street or read newspapers don't live their lives like that. They want much more certainty from the people who are the supposed experts. So it's a really important
the differentiation. We live in a probabilistic world increasingly, whether it's physics or genetics. It's probabilistic, not deterministic.
I also
explained to people, they get it. Sorry.
No, I was just going to say, I think one of the problems that medicine has is actually its own remarkable success, which we've basically taken care of the low-hanging fruit. Antibiotics have treated a lot of things. Vaccines have made many things go away.
I would say some of the high-hanging fruit. I mean, you know, 30 years ago, HIV was a death sentence. Today, you have a normal life expectancy.
I'm not someone who has ever argued against the excellence of medicine. All I'm saying is that now we are going after very significant chronic illnesses that are super complex, and they're probably not going to be easy to solve.
They're not, but it goes back to what Joe says. In other words, you know, it's you can do 10 things right in a row and the 11th thing you don't, and that's what the public will remember, like
that's
with
right.
Vioxx. For every Vioxx, there's 100 great drugs that have been brought out and have saved lives and have made people's lives better, but people will hang on to the one thing that gave us gave medicine a black mark.
Now, am I hearing that maybe it's a tough thing to be a scientist nowadays? Because I'm in the business of instilling and inspiring vocations in young people to do exactly that, be doctors and engineers and scientists and inventors and so on. It is indeed. Certainly to communicate that, there's a lot of pressure nowadays on those communities to produce, to be certain, to be accurate. We just have to look at what happened in Italy a few months back when the seismologists there were put in prison for failing to predict the eruption and the landslide. That would scare anybody. I don't know how they're going to fill in their physics faculty.
Well, if I could defend scientists a little bit, they increasingly, in part because of low funding rates, science for a lot of people is configured like a small business. You get a very tiny amount of money if you're lucky to do something. You hire people, you try and produce something, and then at the end, I think you're expected to try to sell it as well, like a small business. I mean, you're not actually selling a product, but you're trying to make people aware of what you do and get excited about it. And of course, you are excited about it if you're doing it. You're like most scientists. So I'm not aware of exactly what scientists say in these articles, but I would suspect they tend to sort of exaggerate the value without maybe outright
lying. We've looked at neuroscience too.
Yeah,
we have looked at this incredible amount of hype, as you probably follow, with fMRI.
I've contributed to it.
Yeah. but you know what I mean? And the wonderful, I mean, I'm a believer in science because it's eventually correct. And actually, neuroscience has done it very rapidly, as you probably know, because the skepticism crept in, particularly with fMRI, very, very quickly, right? And so that shows how the scientific method works. But this hype, at a minimum, makes it inefficient.
Well,
right? It makes it more inefficient.
Personally, I mean, I can tell you, you know, especially if you're junior faculty, you want to get tenure, you're evaluated on how other people perceive your work, including the world, not just your peers, but external sources, the media. You're there in your lab, you're working away, you're working on some small problem, statistical analysis, and suddenly a reporter calls you and says, you know, what can you tell me about your work? And it's very hard to switch gears and explain it in a way that is going to be exciting to that person, but at the same time completely accurate. So you end up making these kind of grandiose statements.
Well, I think that is a challenge that scientists have now that they have to do better on. It used to be that scientists would say, with some justification, I'm doing this stuff, it's really hard, this is what I do, I don't do the communication thing. I think now, not every scientist has to do the communication thing, but if you're working on a project and there isn't someone in that project who can in some way get across what it is, and I'm not talking about what it's going to contribute tomorrow to a disease, but just what you're doing, that's a problem in the modern world. I really think it is.
I think we should try to dial down the expectations of the public. You know, what is the public expecting of science? I mean, probably they're expecting immortality within a few years through some new method of, you know, either drugs or cloning or whatever. They're expecting that we will go to other galaxies within a generation or so. They're expecting things that, you know, may happen. I don't know. But probably not. So we have about 15 million scientists who are publishing the peer-reviewed literature in the last 15 years. We did a survey recently. And how many of us will really make that big discovery that will change the world, will prolong life expectancy, you know, will find a new method of space travel?
Well, I think one of the problems that the biological sciences face is that there have been such dramatic advances in the physical sciences. I mean, we've been to the moon, at least most people believe that we've been. we have the cell phones, you go on Google and you get 2 million hits in half a second, right? So it's very easy to believe that, in cancer research we're barking up the wrong tree because we've done so unbelievably well everywhere else. So, you know, maybe we're not pursuing this in the right way. Maybe those alternative therapists are right.
Continually defend my field, but it's, and believe me, there are a lot of things we haven't done so well. But we now cure 85% of childhood cancers. 85%. I mean, that's an amazing number when you look back, you know, 30
years.
But
that's good news. Media don't report it.
Right. Exactly. That's what I was, you know.
Well, they will report that there are more cases of childhood cancer.
I'm sorry?
Well, they will report that there are more cases of childhood cancer.
Well, there's more vaccines, so of course there will be more.
And all those pesticides.
But we, you know, we sometimes, you know, we can't look at evidence and see it for what it is. I mean, when I was a resident, which isn't that long ago, in general surgery, we used to cut the vagus nerves to the stomach to cure ulcers because we were convinced that it was too much acid was causing ulcers. And we were noticing that we were, you know, sending the stomachs or taking biopsies and sending it to the pathologist. They were finding these little bacteria, but we were just writing it off, oh, you know, just bacteria, big deal. And there we were doing invasive surgeries, cutting vagus nerves with all the side effects of that, until finally said, why don't we try an antibiotic against this bacteria? And lo and behold, H. pylori was, you know, found to be one of the causes of gastric ulcers. And took us, even though it was facing, you know, right in our face for so many years, it took us a while, us meaning, you know, the doctors, to clue in. So, you know, we're not infallible, and medicine does make mistakes and does take two steps back sometimes. But overall, I think people live a better quality of life and a longer life through those advances.
And Google, but I think you have to get across the message that the scientific process is one where you do the best thing you have. H. pylori, for instance. Now there are a lot of reputable people who say, you shouldn't be getting rid of H. pylori. That's a reason, you know, that's a beneficial bacteria, or you can get rid of it in middle-aged men like me. But for moms giving birth, they should have that. And there are lots of people looking into this now, and it may turn out to be that they're right. We don't know, but we should try to make people understand that the best we can do is this scientific thing.
Right.
And then when we get new information, we'll do a better thing.
And that's not good enough for the public.
I think it is.
I think people understand uncertainty. I think if you were to explain the 0.5 to 7 degree thing, they would understand. I mean, if you say to someone, in the next 10 years, between 0 and 100% of your house will burn down, they'll happily pay $100 a month for insurance, right? So, I mean, why can't people understand the, to me, identical logic of in the next 50 years, between 0.5 and 7 degrees of warming will occur unless you do something, and it might not be pleasant?
There's been lots of, you probably know this, lots of studies have shown that people are just terrible at this kind of probability stuff, and they just cannot process it, you know? They can't and they don't know the difference.
Travel is one of them.
They don't know the difference between 1 in 1,000 and 1 in 100,000, right? I mean, they're very difficulty processing it. And also with the good news, right? I mean, there's a study that just came out recently that showed that most people, I think it's colorectal cancer, think that their palliative treatment is going to cure them, right? Mm-hmm. They believe that, you know, because they hear these stories so often about cancer cures, they think that they're going to be cured by a treatment. In fact, I think it was 85%. And the other big phenomenon, I think, that happens is big science, right? You know, everyone has to keep the story, they have to keep the narrative going, whether it's stem cells or genetics or even neuroscience, right? So all of these things, I think, add to an atmosphere of hype that is not conducive to good science.
Well, this is something that I can tell you we talk about a lot around the lunch table. And the question is, how necessary is it? I mean, if you look at a program like NOVA, I assume it has good ratings, right? People watch it. But it's not talking about curing things. But it's been on for a long time. I assume someone must be I watch it.
Yeah.
I mean, the point is people do find this stuff interesting. So the hype largely comes from the idea that you're told through the granting agencies, which come through the politicians, that you have to be promising something at the end of this research. You have to write it into your grant. I'm treating this disease. But I wonder if you just told people what we're doing is curiosity-based research. We're looking at it, how something works. We don't know very much about it. We're going to try and find out how it works. And that's it. At the end of this, you're going to know a little bit more about how the brain works or how you know, the universe works. Would that be the end of research? I doubt it. And I think
if you also told people that's basically how all the important discoveries are ever made. You study this, but actually in the end you find something else.
And if you put that alongside with the actual price tag of it, which is tiny, right? The cost of basic science, curiosity-driven science, is divided by all the taxpayers in Canada or the U.S. It's probably a couple hundred bucks a person a year.
You have to convince the politicians, though. You don't have to convince. I mean, in Canada right now, there's a, as you know, we're writing grants. It's kind of, it's a huge push now to commercialize. It's not the public You have to convince the politicians.
But the politicians, I assume, would follow the public. I'm not sure who's leading who, but you know, this is. It doesn't seem like it has to be this way.
I'm with you.
The hype is being driven by the felt need of scientists to survive in a climate where the funding rates might be 10% or less in the U.S. And they, I can tell you, I don't enjoy sort of spinning things. It's not my job. I like to just do my science. But you feel like you need to do that. And of course, if you're a scientist and you don't have in your mind some vision of how your work could eventually turn into a Nobel Prize, you're probably not a very good scientist. I mean, you've thought about this, right? So it's not so hard to come out and say it, but of course it gets misinterpreted or maybe exaggerated when you say it. But I wonder why we need to say it. I don't know who's ultimately driving this process. I don't think the general public is averse to the idea of people just studying.
Well, there have been studies, and the surveys, but they have shown exactly what you said, that the public understands basic science, and they're warm to the idea of basic science. Look, they love hearing about space travel, and that's really basic science, and they love hearing about, I'm going to use this phrase, the God particle. Now, they love hearing about that stuff, and that's basic science. So I agree with you, but you know, right now we're studying where this pressure is coming from, and it's coming from everywhere. It is coming from absolutely everywhere in the scientific community to sound practical, to sound exciting, to sound commercializable. It's at provincial, the federal, international, institutional, it's everywhere.
Well, we only have 3 minutes left, so maybe one more point that I think would be interesting to discuss. Each of us interact with the public in some way, and we each have kind of a feel for what the public most worries about. And I think it would be interesting to have a go around to see what the impressions are, because I know that we kind of all live in separate worlds, you know? I mean, for me, you know, because I live in the world of bisphenol A and phthalates and endocrine disruptors, I think that everyone out there is interested in that.
What a fun world.
Yeah. But, you know, when you actually go out, and Kirsten will agree to this, right? I mean, we're interested in this because we live it. But when you go out there and ask your classic man in the street interview, they don't know. They don't care. They're worried about something else. So I think sometimes we get a different view of what the public is really concerned with. So I think it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I know Lauren thinks that the public is really concerned about Wi-Fi and cell phones. And
Yeah, I can actually, this morning I participated. Today is in Ottawa. There's hearings taking place for public input on what Health Canada should do with its safety codes regarding wireless and cell phone stuff. And I put my name in, so I got to say 10 minutes worth of stuff of mainstream science, but just amazing how much public concern, at least of this thing there was. And, you know, one of the things you keep hearing, this is true for Wi-Fi or for bisphenol A or anything, is people say, you know, until we're absolutely certain that nothing bad will ever happen, you know, we should take precautions. And science can't prove a negative. And that's true for many, many aspects of, you know, science, so-called scientific controversy nowadays. You know, where health agencies like vaccines, where they say that it's safe, but, you know, can you prove 100% that nothing bad will ever happen? No. Even with vaccines, there's a very tiny risk of, you know, some diseases. In the United States, you have some kind of a special tribunal for the very, very, you know, 1 in a million cases or whatever, where some side effect occurs. But how do you communicate to the public, you know, that there's no such thing as 100% guarantee on anything? And you've got to live with a certain amount of uncertainty.
And Bill probably thinks that what the public cares about is what the Kardashians do, right?
That and I think, though, as we get older, I'm getting a lot of people terrified about the fact that, I mean, we've helped to cure some diseases. Alzheimer's, everywhere I go, I reach people of a certain age, and that's a number one concern, that they're going to lose dignity, that there's no cure, that all is hopeless, and oddly enough, more interest in that than in the Kardashians, trying to find something. It's interesting how, like, 20 years ago, no one talked anything about Alzheimer's, and today, everywhere you go, amongst certain age groups anyway, it seems to me something that people are very, very concerned about.
I was going to comment, Lauren mentioned something that happened this morning. I had a phone call from a senior colleague this morning who asked me would I mind if his son, who lives in New Jersey, could call because his spouse is very concerned about the fact that they're building a new house and there's lots of odors in the house, some odors in the house from plastics and the like, and he wanted reassurance so he could give her reassurance. And so we talked, and I tried to indicate that there isn't a lot of reassurance that you can give. If we had a bad contractor, you're probably in trouble, but if you had a good one, it's probably fine. And then I asked him where he lived, and he said Tom's River. And I don't know if you've read that book, Tom's River, but there, and he knew something about it. And I was afraid I opened a big can of worms for him because that's where he lives, and that's where all that toxic stuff from Sibagaigi went on for a long time. So house odors and chemicals in the air is one concern, but I think Joe and I would probably, and Ariel would probably agree that food is probably amongst the most of great concern. Mm. Is it safe? Can I eat this and that? And what is unappreciated is the hundreds and hundreds of compounds that are in food, and everybody's biochemistry is different, so it's an impossible equation.
I think almost everything you've said. I mean, I think in general people are worried about involuntary risks and this idea that there are all of these things out there conspiring against their health. And I hear people talk more about cancer and childhood cancers than Alzheimer's right now. But and I don't think they go in and think, I'm going to deselect from BPA when I buy that bottle. But I think they walk through Target and it says BPA-free, lead-free. And they think, well, that is healthier for my family. So I'm going to buy it. I'm going to bring it home. I'm not going to put it in the microwave. And I'm going to keep everybody healthy. But it's I'm going to go skiing this weekend. And, you know, that's okay. So I think this notion that there is this thing that they can't control and that's all combining together to, you know, hurt their health and hurt the health of their children.
I think you've hit the nail on the head. What they worry about is people want control and they feel things are out of control. All this science stuff is going on, all this bad news is in the media, and I think that's the biggest concern. I think there's also fear, which is different. And what if people fear? I think people fear that which actually poses the least risk to them. So that's, we write about a lot of these things. They fear really obscure things because they're unusual and they're scary, and they don't fear, you know, crossing Sherbrooke Street, which is what they should really fear.
They're afraid of their child being abducted on Sherbrooke Street.
Absolutely. But I think we have to make that distinction between what they worry about and what they fear. And the worry is all about control because the world is so, seems to be moving so quickly.
Well, what is really interesting, I find also in terms of what we should fear about, there are some fads, you know. One day we're going to fear about something, and 5 years later it's going to be completely different, and we would have forgotten that there was that fear. Like, for instance, when we started, or you know, 20 years ago, GMOs, we still talk about the GMO, but GMO was the number one fear. People were worried about GMO. Today maybe it's bisphenol A, although I think it's coming.
GMOs are still on that list. What? I think GMOs are still scary.
Yeah, but not as much as it used to be. Not as much as it used to be.
No, I think in the U.S. it's bad.
Yeah, Canada it's...
Well, not so much in Canada.
Not here.
What?
Not in Canada.
Not in Canada, but and definitely when 20 years ago it was really the
big thing. We're a little behind you, but
so you're going to move there. But that's what I find interesting in terms of fear. Like, for instance, caffeine, you know, it was cancer of the pancreas, and then they found there was this chemical in coffee, caviar palmitate, actually that cure cancer, and then they found that there was this caffeine actually was good for skin cancer, but if you apply it on mice directly onto the skin of mice, you know, and also that it decreased the libido of female mice, you know. They drink on a human scale the equivalent of 10 cups of coffee. I mean, there was all this stuff.
Well, you're always going to make use of these things while they still work.
Yeah.
I think people fear zombies. What I mean by that is...
Especially around Halloween, yeah.
There's this Will Smith movie, I forget the name of it, where in the very beginning of the movie, the scene is the scientists claim they've cured cancer, I think, by creating a virus. Yeah. And then they accidentally destroy everyone in the world. I am legend. And all that's left are the zombies, and they come out at night and they try to eat. And for some reason, Will Smith is still alive. I think people feel like science is delving into something that's unbelievably powerful and complex, which is the working of the universe and the dynamics of it, but that even scientists don't even understand what they're doing. and that they're as likely to unleash something horrible as to create something good. I think the GMO is a perfect example of this. People say you're changing the genetic code, you have no idea what's going to happen. You're just as likely to destroy everyone on Earth as to feed them. So I've heard the zombie fear in various... Or I guess it goes back to Frankenstein, the idea that you're accidentally going to do something completely opposite to what you're trying to do.
Well, as a plastic surgeon, the fears of my patients are a little more selfish. Most of my patients fear my bill and end up looking like John Rivers. Those are their big fears. But I think my patients, like most patients, are to a large degree confused by all the information. As I was saying earlier, many of them now do their research. It's impossible now to get a patient who's what I would call a virgin patient who knows absolutely nothing about what they're coming to see me for. They've all done some sort of internet research, and there's a lot of confusing information. And I think they're coming to me to sort of help them differentiate the good from the bad, as well as giving them my professional recommendation. But I think there's a lot of information, and patients want to be educated, but I they need guidance. They don't know where to go for the right information.
In my former profession, there's one question that comes up, whether you're speaking to school kids or to a university crowd. It doesn't matter. It's invariable. It's always there. It's formulated differently. And people are really wondering if we're alone or if we get visited or if they exist or if I believe in them. I'm always saying it's not a belief. It's so the extraterrestrial question is very much on the forefront. And if you look at the specialized channels on TV with paranormal and ghosts, and there's a lot of those extraterrestrial, it's something, but I would say, people think about it every day. But when they see people like me who clearly don't have more knowledge than they do, other than what's out there, we get the question about extraterrestrials all the time. One of the things that you pointed out, though, is that people are really fearful of losing control. They find that the stock market, they're going to lose all their money, or if decisions are made with health, or if governments can decide, and this and that. So there's a bit of that. But there's also a lot of question about, again, in my field, I get questions out of the blue about whether or not the Earth is going to survive climate warming. Or if we will be hit by an asteroid and indeed disappear like the dinosaurs. And no matter if you tell them that, maybe some species disappeared 65 million years ago, but not everybody, there is no chances, statistically, that if we were really hit by a catastrophe, that every single human being would be wiped out at the very same time. There will always be somebody somewhere that will survive. Statistically, it's almost undefendable to think, but unless the planet explodes, but then somebody would have to explain to me why the planet could explode in the first place. But so there's a bit of that too. But what is interesting is they often fear what they don't know about. Another question they ask people that are like me, had the chance to be spacecraft operators, is, were you afraid at launch, or were you afraid in space? And the answer is, well, not really, because we knew where we were going. We had a good grasp of the vehicle we were riding and operating, and a good grasp of where we were going, because ignorance is really the mother of all fears. Just look at what we feel if you go out there with a microphone about radioactivity and nuclear stuff. Most people fear radioactivity and nuclear, even though, it's right here in this room. And one day it'll be probably our energy of choice. There's a lot of what people fear that is based on not having an answer.
You mean the number one question wasn't how you go to the bathroom in space?
That's second. No, that one is just pure physics. It's pure F equals MA.
You'd be a bit more scared if you saw Sandra Bullock in graphics.
Yeah, which is a little... they're having a good time with the laws of physics.
Yeah.
On that one.
I agree that I think food is a huge nutrition and uncontrollable risks. Like you said, I'm always fascinated. My neighbor across the street is one of the people that won't let her kids walk on the sidewalk. She's going to get abducted. They can't walk to school. but they have a trampoline in the backyard. And my daughter broke her arm on their trampoline. But my daughter can walk on the street. So I do sense this overwhelming kind of health issue. And of late, for me, again, everyone has their own lenses, right, Joe? It's the food, nutrition, that kind of fitness, that kind of fitness thing. It's really seemed to be preoccupying people. Weight, diet, and obesity, yeah, for sure.
I guess my sample is probably biased with a health science orientation, but I think that fears of people are very personalized, and people don't really fear the same thing. Most of the time, it's their main personal experiences that shape what they really are afraid of. And in terms of health, it could be diseases that they have developed, or diseases that are in their close family or in their close friends. What happens next? How do I avoid that happening to me if it's someone else in their environment? It's very difficult to talk to people about prevention, even though they do talk about, you know, what they want to eat or not eat, or exercise or not exercise, or things that they want to try, until it really hits them, either themselves or very close. And then people do get interested to know more. And, the clock is ticking for them as well. So could we use that preemptively somehow? Maybe we could. But it's very difficult to shape personal experiences and therefore exploit personal fears.
Jenny?
I'm going to duck your question. It's a huge... I come from a really, really large country. I can tell you what I'm concerned about and what people I talk to are concerned about, but any sort of general grand statement of what are Americans concerned about, I would feel very uncomfortable speaking on. We have some survey research, and it shows that jobs, the economy, terrorism, those are the top three. Science is way the heck down in the bottom. Climate change is under the table. I mean, you can hardly find it. I don't know what Americans in general are concerned about. I'll pass.
Well, I actually think there's almost a consensus, which is shocking and depressing. But 100 years ago, if you went to your office and you looked around at the things in your office, you would pretty much understand how they all worked. You may have even built some of the things that you were using. Now, I have a phone where if I call my daughter who's in Russia, it goes 28,000 miles, bounces off a satellite, goes another 28,000 miles down, and she gets it in 2 seconds. And I do this for a living, and I have no idea how that happens. And I think, which I'm fine with, but I think the accretion of things in our daily life that we don't understand just sort of wears people down. And that is a control issue, that people just feel like... I used to say in talks, I don't know how my carburetor works. And some guy came up to me after one of the talks and said, cars don't have carburetors. I said, see? But the point is, all these things together are systems that are, I think, it just weighs on us in intangible ways that add up.
It's only going to know what you're worried about, how to get more money for the university.
No, I worry about that, but I'm actually worried about the relationship between an innovation and commercialization agenda and basic scientific research, because basic scientific research is what drives everything. And if we don't have that, if we move in a direction away from that in terms of university funding for research, then we're all going to pay a big price. But that pressure for innovation and commercialization also has an impact on basic education at universities, where the drive is to training instead of education. Mm-hmm. And what we were talking about earlier is education being a fundamental part of the attributes that graduates should have when they finish a university degree, and they should include critical thinking, scientific literacy, and quantitative reasoning across the whole curriculum and not specialized courses. And so those are the things that do keep me up at night sometimes.
And I'm worried about not finishing on time because these cameras have to go to the other venue. Of course, thanks everyone very much. I think it was a fun, interesting discussion.
And
I'm paying a big price with my staff right now.
Well,
I'm in trouble right now.
I know.
Run back to
you. I got to do that for that.